Where were you the other weeks when they would come running in here going, you're not on? Okay. So anyway, where was I?
Master.
Mission. What's your purpose? You know, it's Rick Warren in Saddleback Church. He's talked about what's your purpose-driven life. Without a purpose, without a dream, people wilt, they fade, they perish. So what's your master? What's your mission? What are you gonna do with your life? And what's the third M? Your mate. It's young people, or that's who's choosing who they're going to live life with. That's when they're making life's most important decisions. What's my major? Who am I gonna, find in my life? What's going to rule me? What's going to control me? Is it search for money? Whatever. So those three M's became really key, recognizing that those will impact the kids. That's why I decided to become a pastor to students, and that's why in 19 years in Oakland, I really messed up the average of youth pastors, because a lot of them stay about a year and a half to 2 years, and I did 19 in Oakland when my kids were growing up, and they eventually got on into my youth program, my high school program, and we're on the campus where I was pastor at Skyline and Oakland Tech and Castlemont and other schools. But anyway, real quick, 90 seconds, no, maybe 45. Share something with the person sitting near you, whether it's a spouse or not, your favorite thing about being a parent. Or do you have a favorite thing about being a parent? I decided not to ask what's your least favorite thing about being a parent, but... Yeah, you can talk out loud. This is open forum. And you're not being recorded. If the same person's been talking the whole time, it's time to switch. Anybody have something that they heard or that they said that they would want to share with the rest of us? What's your favorite thing about being a parent? You know what mine is? Mine is seeing in my kids me. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but I had the experience when I first was yelling at my kids in the hall, and I went, oh my gosh, that was my dad's voice. That was freaky. But then, I mean, that's not my answer. My answer was then to recognize that genetically those things that are a part of us, like my dad passed on to me, that the parenting style in some ways, and if I was going to do it the same way he did or be different, I had to choose. But a lot of it, what I inherited was what I lived with. But then there's this whole genetic thing that's so crazy. My daughter Christy, the youngest, the older ones, when she was little, they always teased her about being adopted. You know, you're the adopted one, whatever. And I remember the day she came up to me and she said, you know, Dad, I said, what? She said, I just figured something out. There's no way I'm adopted. Look at my toes. I have feet exactly like you. They're great for surfing. They're like hands, the long toes. She had feet exactly like me, and she was a good surfer too. But the point was, she went, I'm not adopted. I've got your feet. But thankfully, I don't have your nose. So anyway, those become the things. One of the favorite things is seeing qualities that you, particularly your good qualities, seeing them come out in your kids, like a good sense of humor or just, you know. I remember Christy, oh my gosh, I relived my elementary school years. She came home from school, and I sat in around the corner, and she's talking to Pam, my wife, about the first days in this new class. And she goes, and Pam's going, how'd you like it? And she goes, I'm so frustrated. And she goes, well, and this is like early on, and she says, well, what do you like? She says, the teacher gets to do all the talking. And I went, oh my gosh, that was me. I was always in trouble because I always talked. I got moved. And the day that we went to the parents meeting and the teacher goes, you know, I've moved Christy everywhere in this room. I even put her over with the Asian kids who say nothing. And she got them in trouble. True story. So anyway, parenting. What do you like about being a parent? Anybody have a, yes?
In particular, seeing them facing challenges, overcoming fears.
Yeah.
And with one child, it seems that she's just the more sensitive one, and watching her reflect
It is. It's seeing them grow. Yeah. Anybody else? One or two more things? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy to
recognize this is, of all the people in the world, this is the one I held in my arms and I saw born and was been in my family and been in my life since her first breath.
It's like a communication.
Yeah.
You know, that you can't develop without those years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still
yeah. Exactly.
We can't even say they don't like each other, but we know we love each other.
Yeah. Exactly. My wife and I were talking about parenting. We've done a lot in that, particularly since it's kind of been a hobby. Like even our marriage has been a hobby, kind of because unless you work on it, and make it that, it kind of tends to deteriorate. You have to, it's something, a relationships, you have to work on. It's not about just rules or thing. It's about connecting and what you're talking about. And so I was thinking about seminars, and so I saw this. This is so old, but so am I. So, but it is a video that I connect with, and it has a, it's about this class, actually.
Idea, then.
Parent effectiveness training, coping with your child's behavioral challenges. Where'd you get this?
They were sticking them on the windshield at Chuck E. Cheese's.
Come on, look, we don't need classes. We're great parents. All right, you're a great parent, and I'm your lovely assistant.
Well, I don't feel like a great parent. Great parents don't find themselves in the supermarket going, "We don't throw plums." I need a class. We need a class.
A parenting class that's supposed to come natural. That'd be like taking a smelling class.
So you have nothing to learn here.
Oh, come on. My mom and dad never took a parenting class. I'm signing them up for this.
He's signing them up for it. So how would you describe the kind of parent you are in three words to the person near you? Just. How would you describe your parenting style? Go ahead, just talk among yourself. Again, 35, 45 seconds. Aggressive. Just to keep it rolling, anybody want to describe your parenting style in a word or two? Or what you heard? I heard aggressive. What was... It's okay. There's really no wrong style.
I started out joyful and purposeful. And
yeah.
And ended up maybe reactionary.
Okay.
That comes to the surface right then.
Yeah, right. Because you start with purpose and then you end up having to react to situations as they come up. Yeah, that's actually a good description. Anybody else? Did anybody find in your where you are different, like one's lenient and one's strict? Because that's what I find a lot among parents. And I, as I said yesterday, the fascinating truth that I discovered in working with teenagers and families in Oakland is that it didn't really make a whole lot of difference whether parents were strict or lenient in the long run. What impacted the kid most was, or the child, I'm sorry, I'm just a youth pastor, impacted the child most was whether the parents were united or not. If they could divide the parents and split that authority and play one against the other, there was an insecurity that the child developed because the parents weren't united. And I said, you know, I told many parents during those years in Oakland, it doesn't matter whether you're that strict, whether you go with his plan of being more lenient or your plan of being more strict and kind of keeping more control? Because one would say, well, they're really a control freak. I said, it doesn't really make that much difference in the outcome and the end. It's whether you guys are united or not. If you're united front, they will feel more secure. And whether they have to abide by 11 o'clock curfew or dad's 12 o'clock curfew, doesn't mean that much. But you need to be united. You going to say something?
Okay. What about consistency?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was in the thing I handed out yesterday. Is when the kids tell the parents, be consistent. Because if you're not, it teaches me to try and get away with everything I can. They wouldn't really tell their parent that, but that's what I heard from kids. So any other words describe? Okay, we'll move ahead. The very important verse that I heard from my dad when he and I connected would, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. And I heard it after I crashed the Lincoln Continental when I was 12. Some of you were here yesterday to hear about that. I also got in heck of trouble during the World Series because I'm older and it was back in transistor radio days with the little white earplug, and I stuck it down my hand. And when I went to school, I was kind of the sports nut, and I cut out a book. I think it was even Tale of Two Cities or something. And I took a razor blade and I cut out the middle of the book and I put my transistor radio in there and I would lay it on my desk and I'd turn on the Dodger game because I was Southern California, the Dodgers in the World Series, and I could lay and I could hear Vin Scully through the radio. And it was back in the days, the day games. And I tell this to teenagers, they tell me, and they go, well, why didn't you just record it? So frustrating. And it was a day game, and so I had the game there, and then Sunday came along, was the seventh game of the World Series against the Yankees. And I went, no, I couldn't do that to the Bible. Because you read my mind. I went, I get the Bible, I just razor blade it out, put my radio in there, and I went, no. So I wore, as a junior hire, I wore a sport coat for the first time in my life, and I put my little transistor radio in the pocket, stuck it down my sleeve, the little white, and it wasn't the whole hoodie era where you have the hood on and you have the cancel sound different. It was just a little white earplug that came and stuck up my palm, put it down my sleeve. And all during church, because it was in New York, services, church started at 11. By 12 o'clock, it was coming down to critical time in the game because the game started at 9 in New York, L.A. time. And I've got the registration. It was called the Here Are My Cards. And I had the score, and I was passing to all the junior high kids I was sitting with. We had the score going, the whole thing. And it came down. There were two on, came down to the end of the game. And I still remember the player. It was Wally Moon. Hits a double up the alley, and I'm going, because there were two guys on, and they were following the game. And my friend Gary grabs my arm, and it pulls the plug out of the radio. And you can hear Vin Scully's voice. And we're sitting in the front rows of the church. He's rounding third and coming home. One run in, two run in. And the pastor, his name was Arvid Carlson, stops in the middle of the sermon and walks over to this section of junior high kids and goes, Dave, what's the score? True story. That's when I got this verse. In fact, I don't remember much what happened the next days, but I knew when I got out of there, I was in deep trouble. But I got this verse then. I got it and for a lot of other times, too. But it's children obey your parent. What I did not realize until I started to read the Bible for myself was that the verse that is often ignored was the one that he never read to me. It's the one that follows it. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. And I still remember the day I opened my Bible, went up to my dad, and I said, Dad, you never read me this one. He said, what's that? I said, the one that follows the one. And I'll just tell you, since it came to my mind, it's not in my notes, but I remember the day my mom said to me one time, I was probably 15 or so, and she said, I hope to God someday you have kids that give you as much grief as you've given me. And I remember the day I lined my four girls up in front of my mom, and I said, Mom, God didn't answer your prayers. Because my girls have actually been very amazing. So anyway, Ingredients of a relationship. You can have all the rules you want in a family, but if you don't have relationships with your children, you are going to have rebellion instead of response and respect. It's really about relationships. And that's true with God. It's not about religion. It's not about rules. It's not about performance or winning God's thing. It's a relationship. And letting them fail, letting them make mistakes. A mistake isn't a sin. Pam said, you know, Dave, one of the things we need to really recognize is that you with kids, there's a difference. And I said, yeah, I know there's a difference. And she said, there's a difference between childish irresponsibility and willful rebellion. And when they get into trouble or they do something, try and figure that out before you come down hard on them. Was it just childish irresponsibility? Or was it willful rebellion? Because if you're dealing with willful rebellion, that's the hard thing. You got to address that. But if it's just you messed up, you made a mistake. Don't make every mistake a sin. But because it's about relationships, and my relationship with God is a relationship, not a religion, and it's not about rules. It's about love relationships. So, the ingredients of a relationship. Good relationships are built on mutual respect. Respect begins with listening, and when you experience someone listening, you feel respected, and that kind of leads us, in some ways, to the mistakes I made as a dad. Because sometimes when you're busy and doing work and trying to do, a lot of other things, it's very easy sometimes to particularly if you've got more kids than one, they're different, and some will just talk. Like Christy, she would talk. You know, she'd come home from something and just talk and talk. And then there'd be some that you really, to listen, you almost have to pry it out of them. And that's still listening, but it's asking the question over and over again, like I did with Wendy, and saying, honey, I know I've hurt you. Will you help me? I know you feel hurt and wounded by me, but I need some help. I need your forgiveness, but I want some help with that. And listening, then. Good relations are built on mutual respect. Is your family a sand pile? It's interesting I deal with this because the church is a family, too. And when I do our church class at Twin Lakes in Santa Cruz, I talk about the church being a sand pile. Well, families can be a sand pile, too. It's just kind of where it's just a pile of sand. And as the tide moves, the wind blows, the grains of sand move around. And you ask yourself the question, is my family a sand pile where the grains of sand are just kind of free-flowing and just kind of moving around as on their own, or is it a sand castle? Because grains of sand, if you've ever made a sand castle, they get connected and make something really beautiful. But that's where the sand grains or the stones are part of something. They're connected. You know, they're connected to the one on the right and the one on the left. And so when I look at our family, I was telling somebody before this class started about how my daughter has a specific challenge because her husband had a spinal cord injury. And when my youngest got out of school and her husband got out of Loma Linda Medical School, a house opened up. And they were connected because Patrick and Carrie said to my daughter Christy and Darren, would you want to live across the street? And they live there today. They live across the street, three doors down from each other. And it turns out that my daughter Christy's husband's a doctor, and my daughter Carrie is married to somebody who's got a spinal cord injury. So, you know, those kind of things happened because they were a sand castle before they left the house. They were connected. And that's relationship. They weren't the same. Obviously, if some of you were here yesterday, Wendy was very different. But guess what? Wendy also lives right near them too, and they get together with their kids, and that makes a kingdom, that makes a family, and a church can be a family, but a family can be a family if the grains of sand are connected, and that comes from relationship. Anyway, Dave's top 10 mistakes in dad. I mentioned that my daughter helped me with this, so I'm going to hand that out to you. You okay? Yeah, I know you're going to blame it on your daughter, right? Yeah. Take a few. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's all right. It's my clumsiness. Go right and left, I guess. I told you about speaking up here at a father-daughter, thanks. Speaking at up here at a father-daughter conference and being asked to speak because I had four daughters and getting this brilliant idea to take one of my daughters with me to the weekend up here and wondering which one I would ask. And my first response was to bring Carrie or Christy, the ones that really I had fun with and coached their soccer teams, and we just had a lot of fun. And then the idea came that I would take maybe Wendy, who was the one who I had the most problem with because she was very hurt by Dad not liking the things she liked. I liked to be outside, surf, go to the beach, play sports, and she wanted to be inside and do ballet and dance and theater. And I didn't get that. And so there was a lot of hurt that went on. But anyway, so when the time came and I was thinking, who should I take? God just kind of laid it on my heart, ask Wendy at Pepperdine. She was at Pepperdine by then. And so I called her, and she said, well, are you sure you want to take me to speak to the dads and daughters with you? And I said, yeah, I do. And so I picked her up at San Jose Airport, and we were driving up, and she said, what are you going to talk about Friday night? And I said, the 10 mistakes I made as a dad. And she said, you want help with that list? And pulled her backpack out from Pepperdine and got a sheet, and we, driving up 17, coming up here to Mount Hermon, we came up with this list. 10, fail to listen when they're talking. That was hers, because I know that she wanted to talk about those things that she liked, about theater and dance and music and ballet, and I kind of wanted to talk about sports. You know, I'm just going to admit it. That's, you're kind of focused, or work or whatever. 9, fail to remember what it was like when I was their age. That I actually had was myself, because that's what I felt most parents did. When they had a junior high kid or a high school kid or whatever, or were going through a hard time, most parents that I would challenge when we were, I would sometimes even be asked over to the house to meet and kind of, you know, what do you call it? To mediate, that's it. Because you had, you know, parents on one side and kids who were in my youth group on the other, and the kids are complaining to me and the parents, they, you know, I say, well, ask your parents, see if we can come over and just kind of talk about it. And I always was on the side of the kids. And the thing that I often tell them is, you know what, the best thing you can do in your entire relationship with your child is to remember what it was like to be 12. And you may not remember, but try. Because adolescents have this arena mentality. And they would go, what is that? And I said, it's like when you're in junior high and it feels like you're in the 50-yard line or at the center court in a basketball gym. And the entire world is in the stands watching you. So if you've got a zit on your cheek, it's a reason not to go to school. Or if something, you have to, braces or whatever, you feel like you are at center court in everybody. And I remembered that because I remember playing baseball and being a catcher, and we had a big game on Friday. And the winning run was at second base. The guy hit a single. They threw it home. I had a chance to take a one hop. I caught it in the glove. He collided with me back in the days when you could run into the catcher as he was blocking the plate. And I reached over in my glove, and the ball was gone, and it was laying on the ground next to me. I was laying on the ground. And then their other team starts cheering because they just won the game. Monday in class, when I was going down between classes, everybody who looked at me, I knew what they were thinking. He's the one who dropped the ball. He's the one who lost the game for our school. Nobody was thinking that. Nobody even had, but I didn't know that then. I thought everybody was thinking, hey, he's the one who dropped the ball. Or he's the one who missed the free throw. Or he's the one who fumbled in the football game. But Nobody was. It's just that, that at that point in your life, you have this arena mentality, and you're at middle court, and everybody else is in the stands watching you and judging you and saying, man, you screwed up, or you're wearing the wrong kind of jeans, or you're wearing the, you have your hair or something, that, you know what I'm talking about. Don't have the right clothes or the right shoes or the right Nikes or whatever. Fail to remember what it was like. 8, fail to approve and be excited about their friends. I mentioned that yesterday about wrong friends and saying that most of the parents who said they have wrong friends were wrong. They just had friends that were compatible with them, that they connected with, and were maybe angry like they were. And so to not approve of those friends is saying I'm not approving of you either, because it's you're the one who chose them. 7, fail to give them the right to make mistakes. One of the things that changed my relationship with some of my girls was that I worked as hard to catch them doing something good as doing something bad. I was raised with, the only time I got addressed was when I screwed up. But they were pretty much involved with my 14-year-old. My sister was, Diana was 14. It was her birthday yesterday, I called her. 14 years old when I was born. Joni was 12 years old when I was born. My brother was 10 years old when I was born. So all of that was going on in their life, and about the only time I got addressed or dealt with or got read scripture to was when I messed up. But trying to catch your, and to say, wow, that was so. When Wendy brought home Yukiko from school, I still remember that was one of the beginnings. There was a little girl who didn't speak any English, who was Japanese, and she was in Oakland Public Schools, and she was standing on the street outside the school when Wendy was walking up to our house, because we were only a couple blocks. She would walk home from school, and she saw her. And so one day I came home early because I had an evening thing with the youth group, and she's there with her friend Yukiko. And I said, hi, Yukiko, how are you doing? And she started talking, and she goes, oh, Dad, she doesn't speak any English. I went, oh. Well, how did you happen to, is she your friend? He said, no, she was just standing on the street. Her parents got lost or weren't there, pick her up, so I brought her home. And guess what she does today? You can look it up online, it's iSanctuary. She works with Indian Mumbai rescued sex slaves. And she started iSanctuary but that was a picture of where her heart was. Way back then, she brought home Yukiko, who didn't speak English, and she didn't really know her, but she said, you can come to my house. And now she works with human trafficking and iSanctuary in Southern California. But those, catch them doing something good. Affirm that as often as we catch them doing something rude or grumpy or whatever. fail to take time to give them affection. One of the things that I think touch is really important. If you look at Jesus, he was always touching people. And of course, I think part of the evil in this world is that you can't touch anybody anymore. I mean, teachers can't touch, coaches can't touch. Coaches who coach soccer teams, when a player comes off the field, you can't give them a hug, or you're not supposed to. I as a youth pastor, I ignored that. I went, quite frankly, most of the kids that I work with in Oakland needed a hug, guys needed an arm around their back. And I think it's part of the evil of what's going on in our world is that everybody's afraid. Jesus wasn't afraid. He touched lepers. And they were blown away because he thought them touchable. And a lot of kids feel unloved and untouchable. Anyway, so touch your kids appropriately and with warmth and affection. 5, fail to communicate approval. I failed to communicate approval and acceptance. It's really interesting. I did this because I went down to visit my daughter earlier in the summer when I got back from Israel and just to see them after the trip. But one of my daughters, Christy, went with me to Israel with a group of young people. And so I went down to kind of hang with her. And Rick Warren gave a sermon from Saddleback. And he said, one of the things he talked about was what changed his family and his life. He said the one thing that I would do with my kids, and in fact, he had a son that committed suicide. But he said the thing that I learned in these latter years is that love and acceptance. And he had everybody kind of do this question: do you know what I love about you? Do you know what I love about you? Yeah, absolutely everything. And that was the main point of his entire sermon at Saddleback on one Sunday when I sat there and with my daughters, was, you know what I love about you? Absolutely everything. And actually, that's God's love. Because in many cases, we're not that lovable. In many cases, we're not perfect. But if you look at Ephesians 5:20 and how husbands are supposed to love their wives, it says that Jesus loves us, the church, right? Because it's talking about, but he said, I'm really talking about a profound mystery here. I'm talking about Christ and the church, but I'm really talking about husbands and how they should love their wives, the way Christ loved you. And it says that he sees us as perfect. Do you know that? Even as perfect parents. Am I a perfect parent? No. If you were here yesterday, you know that's definitely not the case. But God sees me as perfect, not because I am, but because he gave me that as a gift. So the couples that I marry, and I do a lot of beach weddings at Santa Cruz, when I come to the beach, I tell them, in fact, I just told Ralph and Jennifer a week ago, I said, you know, when you're standing there on the beach, the one thing I'm going to be asking you is about how you love each other and whether you love each other the way Christ loves you. Because until you understand how much God loves you and sees you as perfect when you're not, then you don't understand what I'm asking you to say to that fiancé across as you face each other and repeat your vows. I'm asking you to declare the other one as perfect, even though they're not. Because that's how God declares us. He sees us as holy. He says he presents us to himself as holy. As holy, anybody know Ephesians 5:20, 21, 22? He presents us to himself as holy and blameless, without what? Stain, wrinkle, and now with my wife, that's really critical with me and I, because we've got a lot of wrinkles. Without stain, wrinkle, or blemish, that we're to see each other as perfect, not because we are, but because we give it that to them as a gift. That's what grace is. Grace is seeing us as perfect, not because we are, but because I give you, you're perfect for me. And we're exact opposites. But I tell couples, I married somebody a complete opposite for me. She's an introvert, and I'm just all over the place. She's really planning, and I'm spontaneous, and you can never count, you know. She'll be there if she says she's going to be there, and I say, hey, I'll be there, and then I'm not. We're different. That has flexibility has amazing strengths, but it also has amazing weaknesses. But seeing the other person as perfect, even when they're not, is really what we're called to do. And when we look at our kids, it changes their lives when we say, you know what I love about you? Absolutely everything. I never forget that sermon. And so with my daughters, I said that to each of them, and they went, yeah, right, Dad. And I said, no, it's true. I am so blessed to be your dad. And fail to keep perspective on what's really important. I think one of the things that I learned, particularly as somebody who kind of liked to just do stuff and ask permission later. You know what I'm talking about? There's people who always ask for permission, then there's people who just do it and say it's easier to ask, say I'm sorry than, you know, yeah, it's ask for forgiveness than to. Because if you ask, is it okay if I, 80% of the time it's no. And so I decided to say yes 80% of the time when they want to do something. And that was hard, but to try and be a yes parent rather than a no parent was something that was part of that failure when I first started out with four kids. Failed to develop them their own personal identity. If you want to know about that, you'd listen to yesterday, because that's what I failed to do with Wendy, with her ballet and interest in music and art. Failed to give an honest answer to an honest question. What happens is they stop asking. And then the critical one, which was all about yesterday, was fail to admit when I'm wrong and ask for forgiveness. So that's the 10 mistakes made as a dad, and that's what you have it, so I'm going to pass through these slides. Three promises that can set your parenting compass. One, I promise to do everything I can to place your hand in the hand of God, and that's saying that my plan is not to be your authority, not to be God in your life, and not to control you. My plan, that's not my plan. That's not where we're headed. I promise to do everything I can to protect you physically and emotionally, and that was really important for me as my kids were, you know, growing up in the city of Oakland. And three, I promise to do everything I can to form a loving bond with discipline. And so the question is, what's discipline? Discipline defined is to form a loving bond through discipline means to disciple. And that's why starting on, I just would try and take one kid with me every time I did something. And that's actually why I started dating my four daughters when they got out of diapers. And we'll talk about that in a minute, because that's the progression of steps to independence. Training, a discipline defined as training that strengthens correction and control so order is maintained, but it also is sometimes a system of rule and conduct. And if your child was in charge of your house for a week, share something you think they would change. What do you think it would be? Anybody? Less what? Chores? Boy, every time I've been to the seminar, that's been the number one thing. I don't want to do less chores. Anybody else? Pizza for dinner every night, yeah. Sugar, more sugar. Oh, gosh, that would be my daughters. Five traits of a healthy family, and these, I wish I had the sheet to hand out, but these are the five that impacted me about my own family. Strong sense of being committed to each other. There was just a half, that kind of starts at the top. And I guess it starts with the fact that we said, you know, Mom and I may be wrong, but we're united. We're united in our wrongness, and so you got to live with it. Strong sense of being committed to each other, and it starts with Mom and Dad being committed to each other. Spends time together, and we did special nights, and we'll talk about that, but I was the youngest by a long ways, and I never got to stay up later than anybody else because they were always doing stuff and out and around. And I've seen that in a lot of families where the youngest always gets the short end of the stick, and I was a little more sensitive to them because I was the youngest. And so we had special nights. So Monday was Robin's night. She was the oldest. She got to stay up later than anybody else on Monday night, and rather than every night. And Tuesday was Carrie's night, and Wednesday was Wendy's night, and Thursday was Christy's night. And they're actually doing that with their kids now, because what happens is, unless you spend some time one-on-one with your kids and just make them always have to do everything the same, it never ends up being fair or equal anyway. So Christy on Thursday night, I would hear her say to her older sisters, it's time for you guys to go in your room. And we never said you have to go to sleep. You know, the 14-year-old didn't have to go to sleep when the 6-year-old was out with us, but she had to be in her room, read, do her homework, whatever. But this was the night for Christy to be out with us. She could pick a show, something to watch, or she ended up baking or cooking or doing something fun with Mom and me. And that was, we spent time together, and special nights once a week was even the youngest got to do, which is something I never got to do. Enjoys open and frequent communication. We used to do that with conversation just around the table or in the car or whatever. Expresses affirmation, encouragement often. These are five traits of a healthy family, and number five traits of a healthy family, a strong sense of family traditions, and that leads us to our last.
I'm engaged.
Oh, sorry.
I'm engaged. I'm getting married.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh, my. Oh, my. And that's your engagement ring, huh?
Yes. We got it at a flea market outside of Rome. The guy we bought it from said it was at least 100 years old. Wow. So, Dad, stop it. Say something.
I'm sorry. What did you say?
Dad, I met a man in Rome, and he's wonderful and brilliant, and we're getting married.
Mom, what's he doing?
George.
I had that experience 4 times. The truth is that strong sense of family traditions really makes a difference. And so what I want to do is share with you something that I give my wife total credit for. Is she said, you know, with 4 girls in a 2-bedroom house and stuff, if unless we have a plan, they're just going to be frustrated and no hope. And so this is the reason I left it blank is for your own creative thoughts, because some of you have younger kids and some of you have older ones, but it's never too late to start and have a plan for that day when they do this, when they say, you know, I'm getting married. And so strong sense of tradition, steps to independence, have a plan is, we had special nights, which I just mentioned, and then the dates with Dad. As soon as the kids got out of diapers, and that was in my own, I was kind of the drawing the line, going out with them, that if I didn't have to change diapers, I was a lot happier as a dad. So when they got, and so that was a motivation when the younger ones came along. They went, you mean when I get out of diapers, I can do what the older sisters are doing and go on a date with Dad, go to the hardware store, or just go, you know, to Fenton's Ice Cream in Oakland or whatever. And so that was preschool. Kindergarten, when they could print their name, was they could pick out their own clothes. And boy, that was interesting. But they went to kindergarten at the kindergarten and preschool and stuff, dressed with some pretty interesting. We had, as a pastor, they went to preschool kindergarten at our church. And sometimes the teachers would come up to Pam and go, was it kind of interesting what Robin was wearing the other day? 2 different shoes. And she goes, yeah, that's what she picked out and wanted to wear. They got to pick it out, wear their hair funny with pigtails or whatever. First grade was allowance and make their own lunch. And so they would go to the store and they would actually pick out what they wanted to have for lunch. Because most of the kids ended up by being on campus would trade their sandwich for a candy bar anyway. So we just decided they were going to start to decide what they were going to eat. And so they shopped. We certainly gave guidance, but part of that was a sense of, wow, now for this next year in school and stuff, I get to make my own lunch. And Pam goes, they didn't know it was because I didn't want to make their lunches anymore. But anyway, they got to shop for it, buy stuff, and put it in the bag. And they would always put it together the night before. First summer slumber party was 2nd grade, home alone, short time. And then 3rd grade was their solo plane ride, and every single one of them flew to see the grandparents or family in not too far away. But actually, Wendy went to Wisconsin as a 3rd grader on her own with that assisted, you know, thing, and still talks about it. But those were things to look forward to when they were younger. When in 4th grade or 10 years old, we went on a weekend. We kind of told them a story about what was going to happen, that they would their body would be changing, and Pam walked through our girls with a whole story. It was a book of how their body would change over the next few years, about periods, about menstruation, about breasts, and all of the things, and what boys were like. And we just kind of, rather than just talk about it only with school, with, you know, having a banana and a condom on it, with kids in elementary school, we decided we were going to be the ones that talked about it with them. And so we went away for a weekend, and they got to pick where they went. I was just talking to Carrie because she was just up here last week, and she goes, yeah, I picked Yosemite. And I went, I remember. She said, that was really important because I got to go with you and Mom to Yosemite, and then we talked about really important things in life, about what was going to happen to my body and change and stuff. And she said, I still remember that. Wendy picked Dream Inn down here in Santa Cruz. We went from Oakland, came down here, spent the weekend. I still remember we had strawberry with cream on it because that's what the hotel restaurant specialized. And she said, can I have that big, it was a huge bowl of strawberries with cream on it. And for a 10-year-old, say, yeah, this is a special weekend. And so we did that with each of them. That's what I'm talking about, strong sense of tradition. When the other ones came along, they went, are you going to do that with me? Yeah. Yeah, we're going to do that with you. This is my wife's plan. Start babysitting was when they were fifth grade. And the own bank account, ATM. And then a teenage plan. Now this is way late for a lot of people these days, but back then we didn't let the other ones have pierced ears because Carrie was my boy. She was bald as a ping pong ball as a baby. And so she would be with three girls, and Carrie, the number two daughter, was just athletic and so we gave her pierced ears really early. But the other ones didn't get it till they were in sixth grade. And that was makeup too and stuff like that. I mean, obviously not makeup for school, but. Oh, and then we went to the Pearl Factory in sixth grade and in the city. And this is part of this whole, we have the cell phone in seventh grade. But let me just share one little experience that we had, which is tradition, we went to the Pearl Factory at Pier 39. Do anybody know what that is? It's where you have the oysters and the pearls, and they crack open they have a big tank, and there's oysters, clams in there. And it's called, they pull one out, or you get to pick one out, and they go aloha, and they crack it open, and if there's not a pearl, you open another one and open up. But what we had them do was tell them the story that said, you're becoming 13, and we're going to have you hear the story of the pearl. And so we didn't tell the story. We had the person behind the counter who was selling the pearls and the oysters and clams and stuff tell the story. And they open this big book, and they fold, and they turn the pages, and they show what the oyster farm is and how they do it. Anybody know how a pearl gets made? What is it?
Piece of sand that gets inside.
And what does it do? Yeah, and we say, after they finish the story, these will be the years of irritation. You're 13, and we're going to bug the heck out of you just by being your parents. You'll be embarrassed by us. It'll be terribly irritating. But if you don't give up, if you hang in there, these will be the years of irritation. But when you get to the other side, it's going to be something priceless. Don't give up. Because what's happening is something precious, something valuable, something ultimately valuable. And so they would take that, and we bought either a necklace, Christy got a ring, Robin got a little gold box, and the pearl floated around inside her little necklace. And we said, as you wear this over the next few years, I mean, expect them to wear it the rest of their life, but over the next few years, wear this each day, and when you look at it, you realize these are the years of irritation. It's not going to be forever. It's just going to be these next few months and years. And then one of them, I think it was Wendy, who opened it and had two. And so she made earrings out of them. But that was a tradition that Pam came up with. And by the time Christy came along, that was, a month before her 13th birthday, she said, are we going to go to the city? Well, we'd totally forgotten about it because it's been 2 years. She goes, oh, yeah, we'll go. So it's part of having a plan. This was probably the most critical year for our girls. Praise, promise, and present. Eighth grade, in my own experience, eighth grade was the worst year of my adolescent year, school. I don't know, you're just kind of in between, you're not oldest. I just remember eighth grade was horrible, school-wise, class-wise, teachers-wise, friends-wise. It was the toughest pre-high school, but it was just. So we decided they needed eighth grade pills. Pam did. So she got these little gel caps, clear, and made Good and Plenty looking a jar of pills, pink, white, and black, just like Good and Plenty. And on one of the white sheet, she would have a verse, a promise, and that was the promise. And then on the other one, there was a present. Lipstick or a grab bag or get to go to a movie, whatever, just, there was a present each Sunday night. They would They'd actually come out with a jar and say, it's time to open because this, you know, the week's, it's Sunday night, the week's beginning, and we get to open our eighth grade pills. And the last one was a praise, something we really thought was wonderful about them. Present, praise, and a promise. And they opened all three of those on Sunday night for those 52 weeks. My wife did an amazing job putting together creative things and what's that? Yeah. Ninth grade was spiritual confirmation, own bedtime at 9 o'clock. They just decide that what they would, when they would go to bed. Sometimes they had to be in another room, but they could go to bed when they wanted. And 10th, driver's license. This is probably my favorite because it's where I got involved most. And go on the first date, since I had girls, is I told them if they kept up their grades and did well in school and didn't get in trouble and do drugs and all that other stuff, that they could get their driver's license on their birthday. And I'd take them out of school because they'd look ahead and say, yeah, but my birthday's a school day. I go, I don't care. We're going to take you out of school, make an appointment, go down, whatever. But you have to learn to drive a stick. I don't want any girls that don't know how to drive a stick. So I had a little bug, and I still have one out here. And they were mad. Oh, man, they were pissed off because none of their friends had to drive a stick. They all got automatics. They took driver's ed. But they had to learn with Dad with a stick. And I took them over to San Francisco and made them drive the hills. They didn't like that either. But I remember the first one, Robin, when we went down to DMV in Oakland and pulled up. We went several times before that day of her birthday when we had the appointment. And we would follow the driver's test around. And I'm on my kids' side. I want them to know what they would be afraid. But instead, they followed. They drove around and went, and they said, okay, you get a three-point turn. You go down here. And they would even tell their friends, you know, there's actually three different routes that the driver's training person would take you on. And so I know all three of them, where they go and where they. So they were relaxed because they had to drive a stick. So she pulls into their thing, the instructor comes out with his clipboard, climbs in the car, and I'm hiding around the corner and I see her. She waves, hi, Dad. And he talks to her for a few minutes and then he goes, okay, you know, you can see him gesture to go out. She puts it in first gear and pulls out and turns around. In about 3 minutes, she was back and pulls in and I went, oh man, she must have failed. And she gets out of the car and she's got this big smile and I went, how'd it go? She goes, Dad, you were right, which is always fun to hear from your kid. Dad, you were right. We went, turned out, I went down, I shifted a couple times. He threw the clipboard on the floor. And he said, just go up here, turn around, we'll go back. And so when we get home, the other girls are saying, how'd you do? And she says, I passed. And he goes, well, what was it like? Told him, and then I didn't have a problem with the rest of them. I said, can you teach me to drive a stick? I'm only 14, but I still like to learn now. So that's, I mean, those become kind of traditions of experiences and taking each of them to the DMV on their birthday and getting their license and teaching them how to stick because, anyway, you got to go. We're done. Visit college campuses. The 11th grade year, we tell them, you pick three schools and we'll go visit them. Not all of them you have to fly to because we couldn't afford it, but local. They went from San Diego State to Westmont to Seattle, and during the 12th grade year, it was their own curfew. Not that they didn't have to tell us when they were coming back, because they had to say, well, we'll be home, but my friends are doing, because when they're in college, they're going to do whatever they want anyway, and so I often heard parents say, as long as you're under the roof of this house, you're going to abide by all of our rules, and to me, that kind of progression ends up with strict, 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 and then wild decisions. And I would rather have them make mistakes and do failure while they're still under my roof and make bad choices where I can support them and be there. And I always had this agreement, this is the last thing, is from the time they were junior high on, if they were at a friend's house, if for any reason you feel unsafe, you call. I will come and pick you up and I will not ask you one question. And that happened several times where they just called and said, will you commit? It was 1 o'clock in the morning and they were at a slumber party, a girl's slumber party in Oakland. They called and I said, you okay? She said, yeah. Can you pick me up? I said, yeah. Got in the car, and she got in. It was like 1:30 by the time I got there. We were driving home, and we were quiet. I said, you okay? And she said, yeah. And then we got almost in the driveway, and she said, you're not going to ask me any questions? And I went, no, I told you I wouldn't. That was kind of just one of those, I wish I knew, but I still don't know. But she made a good choice, and I was there. So that's part of the 12th reason for that happening in 12th grade instead of waiting until they go to college. Anyway, let's pray. God, thank you for families, for those that you put in our care, and we pray for them because they are making life's most important decisions in these coming years, and you have given us a heavy responsibility to love them and lead them into a relationship with you. And we pray in Jesus' name, amen. Thanks, everybody.